Welcome to Gluck Radio. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, executive life coach and master problem solver. Today we're joined by Marion Winnick, author of Highs in the Low 50s, How I Stumbled Through the Joys of Single Living. After her first husband, who happened to be gay, died of AIDS and her second husband divorced her, Marion was left in the unfortunate position of being a single woman in her 50s. And boy, did that lead to some stories. How did an author and mother of three almost end up going to bed with an Hispanic construction worker who was working on her house? How did her experiences with everything from online dating to ambiguous feelings for her ex change her? We'll talk about the art of romance for those of us who've been around the block once or twice.
Winnick will reveal how she attempted to rebuild her world under the harsh reality of dating in her 50s. If you're in her shoes, you'll be able to learn a thing or two from her pain and rejection. Her book is brilliantly written with warm humor and biting honesty.
Marion, welcome. It is absolutely my pleasure to have you on the show. You are telling a story that there are so many women in their 50s that have different experiences. Your experience is not unique, and I'm sure that you've spoke to, though your life is unique, actually. So let's start with the uniqueness of your life, because I really want to hear this. You were married to a man who you actually knew was gay. Now, Tell me about that. Why purposely choose a man who is gay, who's not going to have the same sexual feelings towards you that a straight man would?
Well, okay, let us go back in time, because I was 23 years old when all this happened. I certainly did not have the preconceived idea of, you know, finding a gay man to marry. But I went to Mardi Gras with my friends, and one of the people that they were excited for me to meet was a guy named Tony, who was described from the start as Tony the gay ice skater. He was a figure skater. And though he was no longer figure skating, and he was bartending in a gay bar. Okay, so it definitely was, I was prepared to meet someone who was gay, but I wasn't prepared for the reaction that I had to him. So I literally fell in love at first sight with Tony. If it was a Disney movie, I would have had the stars and hearts rocketing around my head. I did not make one rational or logical decision for quite a long time after I first set eyes on him. I think I sat on his lap within the first 10 minutes of meeting him. So
why so long?
I don't know. You know, it took me that long to get across the room. But the thing was that he had, you know, he returned my enthusiasm quite, we were just crazy about each other. And it wasn't like obviously didn't really fit in with the labels that were active for us at that time. But we just didn't, I kind of wondered, how can this be happening? Is this happening? What does it mean that this is happening? But, I was definitely going with the flow.
And what happened with the sex? I mean, he had the right equipment for your desire, but how did the sex work for him?
Well, I wish he was not dead so you could ask him that question. It was a little rocky getting, the whole thing was a little rocky at first. And but then, we kind of figured out, I don't know, it seemed, I always hesitate to say Tony was bisexual, because he wasn't really bisexual. He just kind of had an exception, I think. I was an exception to the rule. So we had, sex. I don't know. It's funny to talk about after all this time. And I'm raising I'm done raising our two sons, pretty much. They're 25 and 23. I think it worked. There was a beginning period where our love and passion was so intense that it allowed us to find a way to be together that, you know, was really pretty romantic. And then, you know, I think later in our marriage, I think Tony had other relationships. And I didn't even know about it until after he was dead, because it was not an open thing. But oddly enough, I found out about it when I was going on Oprah to talk about the book I wrote about him. They actually dug up someone that Tony had had an affair with, and then they were saying, well, how could you claim that you had a monogamous relationship with this gay man, because we have this guy on the other line. And so that's how I found out about all that. And once I found out about it, you know, I wasn't that shocked, and because things were more strained between us on that level in the later part of our marriage. And certainly, you know, he also spent like the last couple of years of his life dying of AIDS, which is not a sexy time for anyone.
No. So. How, I mean, thank God that you never picked up the disease. How did you avoid that?
I would say the grace of God.
Anything more specific?
No, because first of all, when I met Tony, it was a couple of years before we even heard of AIDS. So I'm sure Tony was already infected, and it was literally more than 2 years before we read the first article in the New York Times that, you know, there was a test for this new thing. And so by the time we knew about it, it was way too late to do anything about it, you know, about safe contact. So I didn't have it. And my sister was also married to a guy who died of AIDS a little before Tony, and she also didn't get infected. And, you know, now they know that some people have some kind of immunity to it, and these people have been, there have been studies of this, and I think it may have contributing to the science in the area. But in any case, I guess I was immune to it, because I certainly didn't take any precautions. And by the time we found out about it, you know, it was so far down the road of unsafe contact that I felt, okay, fine, I'm going to go ahead and have kids with him, because I also didn't know what was going to happen. You know, in 1985, it was not clear that all those people were going to die. So I thought everything would be fine, and had our babies, and of course everything wasn't so fine, and Tony died when they were 6 and 4. And I don't know, I want to say this because people don't know it. Kids can only get it from the mother. So the fact that I never converted to positive meant that they would be negative too, and they are.
That's a very important point to bring up. Yeah. The marriage with Tony, you mentioned something which I found interesting, is that at 23, when you met him, literally, if someone had goggles, they could see the stars explode. And the frontal lobe, the executive function, doesn't really fully form to 25. Do you think that you made a purely emotional decision, and that later on, if you had to make that same decision at 32, you would have made a different one?
No, I'm sure I wouldn't. I don't think my executive lobe is fully formed yet at 56. If you just read Highs in the Low 50s, I think you know that I'm not really any better at making logical decisions than I was.
But I just wanted to ask the question.
Okay, no, I still, you know, I think one of the long-range effects of that whole thing is that it set me up to think, to look, to expect that experience, you know, like to think this could happen again. You know, you could be that kind of blown away love was so powerful for me. And, you know, to feel that and feel one's capacity to have all that crazy emotion, and, you know, that I was that was an addictive experience for me that I think.
It does seem like you do get attracted, you know, to gay men, that there's some sort of dynamic that makes you attracted. In fact, the type of men you're attracted to, I want you to talk about. You know, you seem to like the bad boy or the really bad boy.
Well, I don't know. I mean, my second husband was he's the least gay person you could ever want to meet, and he's, you know, a philosophy professor. So I don't think I mean, honestly, I do have a big, long history of friendship with gay men, but I've never been romantically involved with another gay man in any serious way. I think, honestly, I wouldn't want to be. I mean, my second marriage was characterized by heterosexuality, and that was a very good thing for me. So, you know, at this point, one component of my type would be straight as far as, you know, romantic involvement.
Can I just interject for a second, and it gets to your second husband as well. He doesn't sound like a macho classic man at all. And I wondered if there were some attraction to androgyny in your personality.
I'm very flexible, Betsy. I mean, you know, like Crispin is not, you know, an NFL tight end type of guy. but he's really very, very straight. I mean, if he has any kind of like, he's not that androgynous. He's more kind of weirdly country western for a philosopher from, you know, Washington, D.C. But
very expressive is what I meant.
Yeah, well, Chris, that was a great thing. You know, Crispin was so opposite of Tony. Tony was not very nonverbal and, you know, gay and really a very physical and sensual person. And Crispin is an intellectual and a great writer, and you know, it was a big relief to me to be able to have conversations after all the many one-sided conversations in my first marriage. As I explained in First Comes Love, I mean, I would say my part of the argument, then I would say his part of the argument, then I would answer his part of the argument, and he would just sit there like, you know, smoking a joint while I did this. So.
Why did the marriage end with Crispin?
It's funny. I was just talking to him about that this morning, oddly enough. I think we were really mismatched in a lot of ways, but we also had the big, giant, you know, falling in love experience that covered up a lot of that in the first couple years. I'm an incredibly outgoing and social and more city kind of person. Crispin is not outgoing. He's a recluse. He really, you know, we lived in the country during our marriage because he really needs to live in the country, but I discovered that that is not a possibility for me. I was quite miserable for 10 years in the country. And so we have these totally different styles. Like, I love parties and partying, and Crispin does not love parties, and he's a recovered alcoholic and doesn't like partying either. And, you know, it just, there's a million things like that. But for somehow, the first couple of years, we didn't notice any of them.
It sounded like Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor. Very volatile, I thought.
Oh, God. It was just, it really was terrible at the end of our relationship because it was so volatile. But I don't know. You know, Crispin has really bad trust issues, and they were completely independent of anything I did, but they seemed to be insurmountable. And, you know, there's a lot of sad things about it. It's really sad.
You seem to be friends with him now. You spoke to him this morning.
Yeah, well, we share our 13-year-old daughter, and we're good friends. And I think we both feel rueful that we didn't do a better job of being together than we did. But I just don't think we could ever work it out. You know, now that we've been apart for whatever it is, 6 years, it's just so obvious how different we are and how different our lives are and our homes and our everything, you know, and what a stretch it was really for us to be together.
I was fascinated by Jane's reaction to your breakup and to the way you have raised her. I mean, that's an amazing story. You're an incredible mother.
Oh, thank you.
Well, along with this
very my strongest suit, I think.
This very edgy history that you had, and all of a sudden you come along and there's all this domesticity, there's this careful parenting, and this wonderful daughter, Jane.
Well, I hope we're not forgetting Hayes and Vince.
I've
been a mom since I was in my 20s.
Right.
And, you know, I was a single mother for 5 years of that of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, the mother I am with Jane is very much, you know, the fact that she's round two. I mean, first of all, by the time she was born, I already had teenagers. So I was so much more relaxed about everything, you know, and not nervous that I was going to mess up. But also, she's almost like an only child. So I've gotten to have this very intense one-on-one relationship with her, especially since her father and I split up. And yeah, I'm so lucky. She is great. And I really don't know where I would be without her. And I'm already mourning, you know, 4 years from now when she leaves, it's going to be awful. So.
But I think you make your own luck. I mean, in this case, you nourished her in the most sophisticated way. I mean, I love your comment that inner peace and strength is the greatest resource you can give your children. And not only that, you even cook for your kids. I mean, most of the time, which I thought, oh my God, we're back in the 50s here.
I'm always cooking. In fact, my 23-year-old slept here last night because his band just got back from being on tour and is leaving again. And yes, I definitely saw them sniffing around the fridge to see what leftovers would be in there.
Well, you are a good mom. And I want to jump into your experience on Oprah. In your book, you mentioned that it wasn't the best in the world. What
it was the worst in the world?
Tell me why. Oprah herself or what?
The whole story is, okay, first of all, this is before Oprah even had her book club. So when they called me up and said I was going to be on Oprah, I was like, why would I be on Oprah? I didn't even understand it. And I thought Oprah was something more like Jerry Springer. I didn't even want to be on it because she didn't have this reputation for being a lover of literature that makes bestsellers. But they, you know, I guess at Random House, they had already figured this out. And so despite my reluctance, okay, I'm going on Oprah. And she's doing I was first told she was doing a show about my book. Well, okay, I thought this is great. She'll read First Comes Love, and, you know, that'll be great. Well, then I got a call saying that they needed to find other people who were married to gay guys to put on the show with me. And then I started getting nervous. Like, first of all, I don't even know any other people that are married to gay guys. And second of all, are you sure this is going to be a show about my book? So then that goes on, and they're collecting up people to be on the show and be in the audience. And then I get another call that was the call, I thought you said that your marriage to Tony was monogamous. And I said, well, it was. And they said, well, that really can't be true because we have talked to your friend Terry Jaggers, and he says that he and Tony had a relationship on and off ever since Hayes was born. So this was the first I heard of this. It was, as you can imagine, not a good experience. I mean, this is now
doesn't Tony's sound like a good experience, no.
No, and Tony, you know, Tony was already dead for several years by this time, and I hadn't talked to Carrie Jaggers in years, so I immediately, like, hung up on this Oprah producer and called Carrie Jaggers, and I'm like, what the hell? And he said, oh, I thought you knew, that he thought I knew. Well, maybe he did think I knew, but I didn't know. So this was not a good way to find this out. So now I became obsessed with getting Oprah not to have Carrie Jaggers on the show, because the last thing I was, you know, wanted to do is talk about this thing I didn't even know about and basically had not told. Oh, I have to tell you something so funny though. When people who read First Comes Love hear this after they read it, I tell them, guess what? I found out that Tony was having affairs. They look at me like, I thought it said that in the book. Because even though I didn't know, I somehow enabled the readers to know.
Yeah, I knew when I read the book.
Isn't that odd? And I really didn't know, but everybody else knows. So anyway, I got them not to bring Carrie Jaggers on the show. But, you know, by now my heart is filled with trepidation, and I've had all these weird conversations with producers where they're asking me weird questions, and I keep saying, you know, is Oprah going to read the book? Is Oprah going to read the book? Oh, well, she might or she might not. Well, finally I get to the show, and it's the place is like a madhouse of every person that ever knew a gay person in their life is on this show. You know, my father was gay, my brother was gay, my husband was a clergyman and he was 60 and I found out he was gay. You know, it was a billion people in that green room, and it was just, my heart was dropping, you know, sinking by the minute. And finally I get on the show, and, you know, it was a zoo of people with, you know, some combination of heterosexuality and homosexuality. So finally, it's my interview with Oprah. And she says to me, one of the first, you know, she asked me the question that you asked me, like, why did you seek out and on purpose marry a gay man? Which I was, I mean, I answered it better when you asked it. Because at the time, I was like, well, I wasn't looking for a gay man. You know, I was kind of taken aback by the question. And then she asked me if Tony had to be really, really drunk to make love with me. And I apparently had said something to, you know, there's a lot of partying in our book, and the producers had asked me about that in one of these phone calls. But I did not have any idea she was going to ask me this question, and I was really, really upset. Like, I always thought I should have just hit her, because then I would have been famous and my book would have been a bestseller, because I felt like hitting her. I was like, and I just said, what? So she repeated the question, you know, did he have to be drunk? And anyway, the interview was horrible. And I was pretty sure I thought they would never even air the Oprah episode, because the whole thing was, it seemed ludicrous. And my interview in particular was terrible. She pronounced my name wrong when she introduced me. I mean, it was so obvious that she didn't read the book. And she was sick that day, and they had to keep, you know, stopping to get her tissues and coughing and stuff. The whole thing was just a catastrophe. And then it didn't air for like another 7 months, which was no surprise to me because it was so bad. Then I'm in the hospital with my little sister, whose second husband has just died, leaving her 9 months pregnant. And I'm in we're in the hospital. It's this whole big drama. She's hemorrhaging and having this baby as a newly widowed mother. And the TV comes on in the room we're in. And it's Oprah saying, today we will meet women who have heard the three words we all dread. Honey, I'm gay. So this over-air thing aired right in the middle of my sister having this baby.
Oh, my goodness.
And in the hospital. So it was the ultimate end to the total disaster that it was.
How about the public reaction to your marriage? And the other thing about public reaction is the Salon piece, I think you wrote about. It was an excerpt from your book,
right,
Your Date with
right.
William, and you got something like 500 plus of vitriolic comments.
I was really, really mad. Because
why?
I really think it had to do with the excerpt being taken out of context. Because mostly people were going crazy on me that I was some kind of materialistic, you know, little princess. Because at the very beginning of this date, the guy said that he was homeless, jobless, penniless, and living with his mother.
Yeah, that and, actually, you know, sounds like you're materialistic.
Right, and I had kind of a negative, I thought, it's not too good, is it? You know, so I start pulling leftovers out of my fridge. Most of the negative reaction was about my negative reaction to that. And, you know, I think if people read the surrounding book, they're going to realize that I'm the furthest thing from someone who's, I mean, I've already dated an illegal alien construction worker, you know, it just was, they didn't really get me, and people were way off on their own feelings. You know, people wrote in, well, I am jobless, and I am certainly hoping that that will not mean I cannot get a date. And
it means you can't pay for the date.
And didn't they drag in your and they dragged in your relationship to Tony too, didn't they? I mean, another sort of
some people. Well, it wasn't in that excerpt, but there was a couple people in there who knew who I was.
That's right.
Were like, oh, this crazy woman. She's, you know, already dated a junkie AIDS. You know, blah blah blah. I mean, what else is new with Marion Winnick? And honestly, you know, really, what else is new with Marion Winnick? I mean, but. I guess this guy was one bad choice I really wasn't going to make, you know. And I guess if he had been homeless, jobless, penniless, and I had been wildly attracted to him, it would have been a little different. But top of everything else, I wasn't into him.
To something else, there is something new with Marion Winnick, because in this book, Behind the Low 50s, there's a narrative trajectory. I mean, you move from this feeling of dejection and despair, and, you know, you've lost your swerve. You know, you used to be the sensual, sassy, smart person, and now you feel like Higher the Handicapped, and, you know, you're meeting all these jerks, getting dicked around, all that. And then at the end, you know, you have this sort of awakening and you say, I'm happy. Hey, being single is great in your 50s. I'm independent. I can make my own clam pizza the way they do in that great New Haven restaurant. I've been there, by the way. That is fantastic. And so, you know, I do think there is something new in Marion Winnick, don't you think?
Well, you are a great reader, Betsy, because you got the point of my book. Thank you.
I'm so glad.
Yeah, no, that is true. I mean, I certainly, I can't say that I have completely lost interest in, you know, finding some kind of love and passion. That would be great, you know, and I hope it happens as soon as possible. But I came to really, really appreciate my independence and my, you know, because I had been married. One of these, my marriages was, I've been married or with somebody continuously from when I was 23 to when I was 50. And since I've been, now I'm 55 actually, and since in these 5 years, you know, this is good for me. I like being in charge of everything and not having to boss someone else around or take their point of view into consideration or, you know, possibly be bossed around by them, God forbid. And so all that's good. And then I also did not like the manhunt. And that's where I'm sure many can bond with me. This whole hunting and going online and dating.
Oh, I need to know your Match.com experience.
Yes, I was going to.
You have to. You have to go very short.
What was it like?
I hate it. I mean, I don't like this shopping for people thing. I found it really awkward. First of all, I'm not like other people because my whole life is already in the public domain and I have the job, you know, I found it very difficult to like select certain things about myself to put in this profile. And, you know, profiles are like these weird advertisements and then you're supposed to fill in little blanks as necessary until you get a whole person. I could never deal with this measured approach. Like what would happen is someone would write to me and I'd say, okay, go to marionwinnick.com and see if you still want to date me. So I, first of all, the whole thing of the way it's a way that private people can connect. It didn't really work because I was already too public. Then B, I hate rejection and I hate rejecting people. So I couldn't stand any part of this, like where people write to you and then you don't write back to them, or if you do write back to them, even just to say, thanks for contacting me, but then they will contact you and you have to be meaner to them to get rid of them. Or you go on the date, you go meet someone for coffee, and the second you walk in, you know you don't want to see them, but you have to tell them this. And I was so bad at this that, you know, I was basically saying, okay, we'll be friends. I mean, I, you know, and I was sort of like thinking that the choices were date them or be friends with them, not date them or just throw them back into the pond. And I, the throwing back in the pond thing, just ick. I don't, you know, that's not a part of normal dating. I was just going to say, normally, you know, you know a lot about whether you're interested in someone before you even consider being involved with them, you know? And this seems to put the cart before the horse. Like you're considering getting involved with them, and then you have to backtrack if it doesn't work out because you don't know anything about them. Anyway, I hate it. And I would never, I just can't, you know, every once in a while I'm so bored that I think, oh, I should just get back on OkCupid or something. But then I remember how awful it is and I don't do it.
But you speak about the dating ritual and how you've sort of forgotten how to do it. I mean, who could blame you? I mean, you know, you've been out of the rat race for a long time. But I thought it was very funny when you listed all the things that you did wrong, all the things that you said that were wrong on the first date. I mean, you know, every time you go online, it's hilarious. The things that you do say and don't say in order to attract a guy. Apparently, you got Brett interested in spite of all of that. But again, being out of the game for X years, you get into the whole dating war business, and then you forget those flirtatious skills and dating smarts, don't you think?
Well, if I ever even had them, I mean, you know, I don't even think I ever really dated. You know, people didn't really date in the 70s. They just had, you know,
I just hooked up. Yeah, but you're a good flirter, Marion. You do have that gift of gab and interaction, and you still believe in love and magic And so it shouldn't be all that hard for you. It's either there or that. It's either there or it's not. Obviously, what you have a problem with is what every fisherman does every day. He goes out, he puts his rod in the water, he waits a few hours, and then he gets a bite, and then he throws it back. You have a hard time with that process. But let me ask this question, because you have so much life in your voice. What do you do when you're lonely, and what advice would you give to women in their 50s who are just really suffering from deep loneliness?
Oh, I hate to think of that. You know, I mean, I think we have a lot of resources that we might be undervaluing. And I mean, like our kids, our friends, our colleagues, our extended family. And these people mostly already love us, you know, and want to. And so it's not the same as having a partner. I mean, there's certain times when you really can feel very solo. I think it's particularly when something bad happens to you. And in my case, I have no, you know, my parents are dead and I don't have a partner. So like sometimes if something bad happens to me, I often feel like, God, I'm all by myself here, you know. No one is invested in me that this is also their problem. And that's my loneliest times are when I realize that I can't get that kind of comfort that you get from someone who invests in you the way a parent or a spouse does. But other than that, you know, I spend time with my friends, and I see my sister more, even though she lives 5 hours away. I see my best friend more, even though she lives 3 hours away. I see my friends here more, and I certainly try to, you know, keep my kids in my life. I'm really lucky that all three, one lives here and two, the other two live in town. And, you know, I make a lot of effort to keep those relationships, you know, lively and stuff. And I have dinner parties a lot. I mean, I suggest people have dinner parties because if you invite people to your house to eat, they will come. And it's fun, you know, it's fun to have people over. So I've been having the past couple months, I've had a Sunday brunch almost every Sunday. And I just invite whoever I run into that week or, you know, some of the same olds too. But I think you can, you know, you shouldn't just wait for fun things to happen to you. You should make up some fun things and, you know, that you want to do and do them. I'm sure there's people that want to go on trips that they're not going because they don't have a partner to go with. Well, I bet they know someone who would go. So you just have to stop thinking that you can't do the things you love because you're alone. You can do, well, there's one thing you love that you can't do by yourself, but everything else you can.
But tell the story about the snowstorm, because that's just a miniature example of that huge support group that you have in Baltimore right now.
Well, the snowstorm came in, you know, it's very much in contrast to my years in the country, because for 10 years I had lived in a house with a quarter mile long driveway in Pennsylvania. So whenever it snowed, it was like a disaster. You know, my driveway would be 3 feet deep in snow and I could, you know, it would take a long time to get it plowed. So not only was I isolated, like the nearest neighbor was a mile away, but I would be isolated longer than anyone else because of the driveway. So by the time I left Pennsylvania, I had like a phobia of snow. Like it would start coming down and I'd start freaking out because I was going to be, you know, stuck in a house for a week with a bunch of little kids and nothing else, you know. So in Baltimore, I live in a totally different kind of neighborhood with, actually I live like in a duplex and there's all these sort of small houses all together. So the first time it snowed, after I moved here, there was a huge snow. It was 2010, I guess, and it kind of shut Baltimore down for 7 or 8 days. And it was the greatest thing ever. I mean, I had all these neighbors that were just 5 feet away, and everybody was coming over each other's houses, and people were having potlucks. And I actually made a couple friends that ended up being my best friends in the neighborhood. And so it was a glorious confirmation of my thanking God that I got out of the ruburbs and into the city. So,
I mean, I think it looks toward the future of marriage. There's so many living arrangements, so many co-parenting arrangements now. I mean, it really does take a village. I mean, there's no reason for anybody to be lonely. And it turns out that's a global epidemic right now.
Hmm.
So anyway, you've found a solution, I think.
I have, you know, I'm kind of the worst case scenario for online dating because I have a lot of friends that do it and they seem to, you know, some of them have had very good luck, like they're with someone they met and it's working out great. And other ones at least get some fun and entertainment out of it. You know, so I don't say that online dating is totally bad for everyone. It's just I'm the wrong person for it.
I think that's the thing that I like about you the most is the realization that who you are and how you operate is who you are and how you operate. And you're not insisting that it's the way it should be for everyone. Because you're right. You know, and that's really one of your many great traits. But online dating, the truth of the matter is for those who cannot go into a social setting and make contact is an excellent way of meeting people. But for someone like you who actually is very friendly, you're a social animal, you can interact. It obviously, and you are a public figure to some extent, it doesn't work for you.
But yeah. You know what I also think? I mean, at my age, the amount of like people that would be Mr. Right for me who are available and not, you know, married or dead or whatever, is small. It's a small, I don't think that there's like, you know, necessarily dozens of guys that would be okay. There's not. I know there's not. And you know what? If I meet one of them, it's going to be great good fortune, but it's not likely. So that's why I think I shouldn't be bothering trolling through these, you know, pools of single 50-somethings.
Marion, is that because your standards are so high or because there are no men out there?
Well, no, it's not that my standards are high, as you may know from reading my book, but it's just because chemistry is what it is, you know. It's what makes things work is, I think, a pretty unique equation. And you know, I've had these wonderful relationships with both my first and second husband and this guy I dated for a long time in between the two. They're so different from each other. So there's not a type or a formula, but there's some, you know, magic that has to happen. And I guess I'm also referring to the fact that a lot of people our age that have good relationship skills are in relationships, you know? So it's not the same as looking for someone in your 20s. You know, a lot of people that you would like are already taken, and hopefully they'll stay married for them. And so hopeful for them, not for me. But yeah, so I think the pool is much, much smaller than it used to be. And that just makes the likelihood less. And
now, Marion, do you have an age range for yourself, by the way, you know, of who you would date age-wise?
I think I would date anyone, you know, that if this all this magic happened, but I would feel anxious about being with a very, you know, somebody like more than 10 years younger than me. And, you know, I guess 10 years younger to 10 years older seems likely, but I'm not totally ruling out whatever, the 80-year-olds and the 40-year-olds.
Well, you must have heard of toyboywarehouse.com.
No.
It's hilarious. 70% of the members are guys looking for older women. you gotta see this website.
Oh, you know, when I was online dating, I would get these things from like 20-something-year-olds that were saying they wanted to go out with a woman my age. But I just say no. I mean, I'm not showing them my wrinkly, you know... I don't think these 20-somethings realize what they're getting into with a mid-50s.
No, you've got a lot of magic as you get older. In my book, Seductress, I have a whole chapter on silver foxes. And all these women who were, I mean, you know, on the wrong side of 60, actually, who pulled in these fabulous guys. So I don't
Ooh,
think...
Bestie, a message of hope. I love it.
The question is, you clearly still are run by your heart and your emotions, which leaves you with always being magical and always having to look down the line because things that are magical often don't stay magical. But is it okay in your mind to be madly in love and it lasts a few years and just do it again? Is it necessary to have a long-term relationship that is simply a comfort relationship and not a magical one?
Yeah, I think that would be great. I mean, it's like if Crispin and I hadn't devolved into a chaotic disaster, I would be happy to have, you know, had a companion and everything. And we do get along. I mean, we are in a long-term relationship. It's just not marriage. I mean, we're co-parents and friends. But yeah, no, I think I would, that would be fine. I just don't know if I don't want to live with anyone. I'm not sure I really want to live with anyone again. I really like, you know, financial and domestic independence. So my dream would be like, you know, someone who lives across the street or in the, you know, I would rather be with someone who had their own domestic and financial arrangements and have a long-term relationship with them. Just because, I don't know, I already have everything all figured out, and I've done this whole merging and melding thing so many times, and, you know, I've gotten stepchildren, I've lost stepchildren. I might want to just keep it simple for now.
But, you know, being autonomous and independent, haven't you attracted more men this way? I mean, there's sort of a BO of need, and were you desperate? I mean, you would do just the reverse. You would cause men to flee in the opposite direction. But
you might be wrong about that, though, because I think sometimes men are not so attracted to really independent, self-sufficient women. Like, they might like a woman who has a little more, you know, is a little more dependent.
You're right in this sense, and you're wrong in this sense. Meaning what happens is very independent men who have a great sense of their personal identity, they don't want to dominate another woman. They don't want to show, they don't have the necessity to control and dominate because they have a full life. And those men who are, in fact, are very, very insecure are looking for a woman they can dominate and they can control, and therefore the weaker you are, the more attracted to you they are. Mm. So it really has to do with how self-evolved the person is.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like I'm going to, if any, I will attract the evolved ones, and that's good.
I have to ask you this because it rings through my head. You've tried therapy. I think you said you had about 17 therapists.
Oh, I don't know how many, but yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, I see a therapist now once in a while, too.
What good do they do for you? Like, what's their role in your life?
Well, I mean, I had one, you know, really, I think one really dramatic thing that a therapist helped me with in my 20s, because, it's a whole other topic, but I had bulimia before bulimia was invented. Like, there wasn't even a word bulimia back at this time. And I didn't stick my finger down my throat. I just mysteriously was throwing up all the time. So I didn't think it was a psychological thing. I couldn't even believe that that was possible, because I never heard of it and it didn't seem likely. And so I never would have been able to conquer that problem if someone hadn't finally gotten me to realize that it was a psychological problem and I was making myself do this. And that happened I was seeing a Jungian therapist in training from the Jung Institute in New York, like in the 80s. And that, I really credit her with this, with getting me to have this amazing insight about, which was a lot, it was, you know, like I say, it was, to me, I thought it was, everyone who said it was psychological was crazy. And so, no, they were right. Okay, so that's one big, huge thing. Then I think in later periods, probably the best thing would be, you know, I went through, a lot of the time that I was married to Tony was very fraught and chaotic, and I needed someone to talk to, and I had a therapist then. Crispin and I saw a therapist who, you know, I don't know if she really helped us much, but I think at least she, when I told her a while later that Crispin and I had split up, she just looked at me and said, thank God. You know, she, I think, was able to reflect that the relationship was in as bad shape as I thought it was. And I don't know. So there's been, I guess I'm saying, yes, there have been some contributions.
But what about self-esteem issues and body image issues? It's hard to believe your voice is so strong. This is an amazing, swanky ego. I just couldn't connect that with self-esteem and body image issues.
Well, you know, but and yet they are huge for me and always were. You know, I don't know. My mother kind of brainwashed me into it, I think, and I've written about this, and it just was, I still have it, but I'm much more in control and have a much more mature attitude about it. But in my younger years, it was really, really a problem. I was a little bit overweight as a child, and my mother was very panicked about it, and she over-supervised me about eating and food, and I just ended up really, really, and also I had a lot of other things wrong with me that were all minor, like pigeon toes and lazy eye and just a big raft of little stuff. But when I, so I felt like I was kind of like the elephant man, except not quite so bad. You know?
Which apparently you were never. But you know what? It is an amazing message of how a parent could build a child's ego because they're defenseless against the information, or how they could, in fact, lay the foundation for years and years and years of damage. So
I really agree with that. And I tell my daughter how beautiful she is every day. I mean, first of all, my daughter is beautiful, so it's not much of a stretch. But I have been, all three of my kids are gorgeous, but I tell them how gorgeous, I've made a major practice of discussing their gorgeousness.
But beauty is a problem too, because, I mean, we're so media poisoned about looks. I mean, we are in the most looksist era that I can ever remember in my life.
Mm. Still, you know, it's never bad to believe that you look okay. I mean, I just think if thinking that you're attractive, if you believe that you're attractive, it's an incredibly important building block of mental health. And because I didn't have it, you know, and I think it's been conscious with me, like, to not do this to my kids, you know, and I want them to, you know, feel that they are great looking, and they are. And
But I'm sure it's coming from within and not from without.
And that's what I was going to say, Marion. Marion, you've not only gave your kids a sense that they're attractive, you gave the kids the sense of they're worthy.
Right.
Okay, because what happens is with attractiveness, it's not just the physical. It's you're attractive because your package is amazing, and people are going to be attracted to you because you represent this amazing package, you know, of both looks and personality and personal identity.
Right.
I could go on forever with you. Unfortunately, we can't. You are a wonderful interviewer, and the fact that you just speak from your heart is so refreshing.
Oh, and so thank you, Dr. Gluck. This is really fun. We could have a talk once a week, and then I wouldn't have to go to my therapist anymore.
Gluck Solutions, you know, just give me a call.
I want to also add that you're a brilliant writer. That has to be thrown in. You know, if you haven't read Marion Winnick, everybody, you got to. You are just fall down funny and brilliant and very insightful.
Well, thank you.
Tell all your friends to listen to this podcast, because we're going to tell everyone who listens to our podcast to go buy your book.
Oh, that would be great. You know, if people go to marionwinnick.com, there's a link to look at the book. I have 10 books now, and they can like look through them and see which one they think they want to read, because really some people want to read that AIDS memoir. Some people want to read Highs in the Low 50s. I have a single mom book. I have a advice for teenagers book, you know, so.
I would say just buy them all and give them to friends after you read them.
There you go. Let's have a party. Have them all.
Okay.
Thanks for coming on the show, Marion.
Thank you. Take care, guys.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
I want to once again thank Marion Winnick for appearing on our show. She was delightful. So what you're going to do is you're going to pick up a copy of her book, Highs in the Low 50s. It's on Amazon.com, and be sure to visit her website, marionwinnick.com. So Betsy, she was delightful.
Absolutely, and her candor is remarkable. Very few people have the courage to say what she says and to do it with so much wit and so much brilliance.
You know, the only thing that concerned me is the fact that she did not see how wonderful she was. I think she was too aware, overly concerned about how her body looked.
Right.
I think that she doesn't realize that there are guys who really want to connect to an incredibly interesting, intelligent, and warm person, and that she was too concerned with the ideas that her mom put in her head that still live there. And I would want them to go away because she's an amazing person. And anyone dating her should be happy.
I agree. But I think it's wrong to blame her mother. I think it's the whole culture right now. We've never been more beauty obsessed than we are at the moment. I mean, we have to just look around everywhere. And there's a cult of youth and perfect bodies and plastic surgery and all of that.
We live in a world, Betsy, of lies, political, economic, institutional, educational. It's part of our job to sort them out and say,
yeah,
you know what, this doesn't fit.
Right.
You know, but having said that, her experiences are unique. She is unique, and this person is going to be around for quite a while.
I agree. Very inspirational and a lot of fun to read.
Oh, she was a lot of fun to talk to. I am Dr. Errol Gluck. Betsy and I both want you to remember, to every problem, there is a solution. Now, I'm going to want you to check out our other episodes on www.gluckradio.com. There literally is something for everyone. And you are going to want to tell your friends, because something is amidst. You're going to, if you haven't already, right now, go out and buy Betsy Prelow's books on the art of seduction on Amazon.com. They're entitled Swoon and Seductress. You will love them. Keep listening. Keep sending us your feedback. Till next time.